From the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, Dr. Janning explains his actions.
What about those of us who knew better? We who knew the words were lies and worse than lies? Why did we sit silent? Why did we take part? Because we loved our country. What difference does it make if a few political extremists lose their rights? What difference does it make if a few racial minorities lose their rights? It is only a passing phase. It is only a stage we are going through. It will be discarded sooner or later. Hitler himself will be discarded sooner or later. The country is in danger. We will march out of the shadows. We will go forward. Forward is the great password. And history tells how well we succeeded, Your Honor. We succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. The very elements of hate and power about Hitler that mesmerized Germany, mesmerized the world. We found ourselves with sudden powerful allies. Things that had been denied to us as a democracy were open to us now. The world said, go ahead, take it. Take it! Take Sudetenland! Take the Rhineland! Remilitarize it! Take all of Austria! Take it! And then one day, we looked around and found that we were in an even more terrible danger. The ritual began in this courtroom, swept over the land like a raging, roaring disease. What was going to be a passing phase had become the way of life.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to the debate, was Bush 43 the worst president of the last 50 years? You can hear this program at 96.5 in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterview.blogspot.com.
I'd like to spend my time talking about the drive-bys we just saw. Let's start with education. We saw a drive-by on No Child Left Behind. Sure, we said states should set standards. We didn't say one national standard because we wanted the people of New York and the people of New Mexico to be engaged in setting standards for their states and to be involved in setting up a system that they would buy into. And in the 5 years since No Child Left Behind has come into force around this country, which requires every state to set standards and to test every child, grades 3 through 8, to find out if the children are meeting the standards for reading, writing, and other material, we have seen more improvement in reading and math and science scores in those 5 years than we've seen in the 28 previous years combined. And the scores have gone up most. The scores have gone up most among the minority communities, black and brown and poor and rural. We heard about immigration with a line that said somehow or another the president threw in with the immigration restrictionist. You know what? I don't think that bill we brought to the floor of the United States Senate was an immigration restrictionist bill. It was a bill that resolved the problem in a comprehensive way, and the president showed courage by standing for it and making it possible. PEPFAR. I heard a dismissal of this incredible effort by the generosity of the American people that is today providing over 2 million people in Africa with life-saving retroviral drugs. Now, sure, we insist upon encouraging programs to educate people about abstinence and faithfulness within marriage and how those can help break the cycle of the spread of AIDS. And it's working. And free trade. I love this one. I love this one. I sat there and was part of the team that bled to win to Trade Promotion Authority. And you know how many votes we want to buy? One. We got CAFTA, which was a no-brainer. Should have been a no-brainer. You know how many votes we got to buy? One. I sat there in that room, in the cabinet room, with 22 Democrats who voted for NAFTA and China and TPA under Clinton, who could not bring themselves to vote for free trade under this president. Why? Politics. So I appreciate the enthusiasm that some of our adversaries here in tonight's debate have for free trade, and I'm looking forward to working with them in common cause on behalf of every free trade measure that comes before the United States Congress. And why don't we make a pact that will start with Colombia? Why don't we do that? Now, about that invasion of Iraq, I appreciated hearing about how it was done on a false premise, and hearing those words come from the mouth of somebody who wrote eloquently about the need to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Appreciate your support at the time. Nice of you to flip-flop now. Easy to flip-flop now. Look, do we wish we'd had the weapons were there and it was justified under those terms? Yeah. Smart people like Bill Clinton and Al Gore and John Kerry and our new Secretary of State designate sat on the floor of the Congress or at the White House in the 90s or in the Congress in the 2000s and said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And we now know that there was a reason why he didn't have them, but he wanted us to think he had them. He told his interrogators he felt it made him look big in the neighborhood. And we know from two reports by Kay and Doeffler that Saddam Hussein was intent upon recreating these programs the moment the West lost its interest in them. So he literally siphoned tens of millions of dollars out of the Food for Peace program to do two things: to keep together the engineers and the scientists and the technicians to reconstitute these programs, and to keep the dual-use facilities to rapidly reconstitute, particularly the chemical and biological programs. Now, I loved also being lectured about sabotaging unity after 9/11. I sat there in those meetings on homeland security where we had a great consensus about the need to defend the homeland by reorganizing our government. And the Democrats insisted on one thing, that the Department of Homeland Security should not be subject to the same strictures regarding union membership that John F. Kennedy put in place for the rest of the government in 1961 and that Jimmy Carter signed into law in 1979. They wanted the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Transportation to be governed by strictures that said in a time of national security certain elements of the agency could be declared off limits for union organizing, but they didn't want that same rule to apply to one department in the government, the Department of Homeland Security, because they saw it as a sop for their union allies. That was not national unity in the aftermath of 9/11, and it was an absence of national unity because there were Democrats in the Congress who never accepted the legitimacy of this president. Talk about the mismanagement of the economy. Let's talk about it. The Dow down 38%. The NASDAQ down 78%. The S&P down 50%. $6 trillion lost in value in 1 year. I'm not talking about today. I'm talking about March 2000 when the market started to go down and bottomed out in October of 2002. Thank God this president had the wherewithal and the political capital and the moxie to pass a large, effective stimulus package of $1.6 trillion over 10 years that got the economy growing again by long-lasting tax cuts that benefited everybody in America who pays taxes. Even the critic Ray Fair at Yale, who forecast that in 2000, his model said George Bush would get 34% of the vote. He was just a little bit off. Said that without this, one out of every 20 American workers who were employed in 2001 and 2002 would not have been employed were it not for the tax cuts. Now, we've heard some other things. We've heard about Yasser Arafat giving blood in the aftermath of 9/11. Well, as long as America wasn't going to throw over Israel as our ally and friend, that was going to be a temporary act of friendship and an enduring life of hate. And Iran, it's somehow our fault, Bush's fault, that the Ayatollahs and the Mullahs and the lunatics are pursuing a nuclear weapon in Iran. I think that has to do with their decision to pursue a nuclear weapon, not us making them do it.
All right, we've got 30 seconds.
In Pakistan, I loved it being lectured about undermining the government of Pakistan. After all, haven't we just elected a president who had promised to invade Pakistan if it didn't comply with America's wishes? Now, look, I will defend the president, and I will defend the record of the last 8 years. Not always successful, but enormously successful over the long term and the long sweep of history.
Carl Rove,
thank you for having
me
here tonight.
Thank you, Carl Rove. And that concludes the opening statements. In a minute or two, we're going to come to you, the audience, again reminding you to keep your questions focused and brief and have a question mark at the end of it. But we now have the numbers that tell us your opinions as you came in off the streets tonight. On our motion that George W. Bush is the worst president of the last 50 years, the Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years, 65% of you are for the motion, 17% against, and 18% undecided. And again, as we said at the beginning, we tend to judge success in this debate by how much you can actually move those numbers. So if that 65% goes up, the side four will have prevailed. If the 17% that is against goes up, that side will be seen to have prevailed.
This is a question for any member of the panel. What president in the last 50 years has faced the challenges that Bush 43 has faced?
Very good and very sharp and focused question. Bill Kristol?
I mean, every president faces challenges, and they're obviously each different. But I think if you're implying that Bush faced particularly stark challenges with a plummeting economy as he took over, and then, of course, 9/11, for which the government wasn't prepared, the country wasn't prepared, the Bush administration, frankly, wasn't prepared, but certainly the Clinton administration hadn't done much to help prepare for. I think the president reacted well to the challenges he faced, and that is what makes someone a reasonably successful president. He made mistakes, as he said recently in the interview. You know, he hadn't realized he was going to have to fight two wars. No one thought we would do that, be doing that in October of 2000. He adjusted in the context aspect of those wars, and I think pretty well. And the same with Homeland Security. They made a couple of mistakes, but basically ended up, thank God, I think, hardening this country in a pretty effective way and putting al-Qaeda on the run by taking the offensive. I really don't understand this. I mean, Pakistan, poor Bush, he gets criticized not promoting democracy in Pakistan enough. Then we promote democracy in Pakistan. We have elections. We actually have a rather good leader of Pakistan now. He has a corrupt past, but has said the right things about trying to curb. Mm-hmm. Well, you can laugh about it, but it's a tough place to govern. He's trying to curb mm-hmm. the ISI and the terrorists. We're now going in aggressively in the northwest frontier to take out al-Qaeda. I don't think that's a mistake. I think Obama is right to support Bush on that. So I think Bush adjusted well to very difficult circumstances.
Jacob Weisberger, the implication of that question is that no president could have done well with these circumstances. What do you think of that?
Well, I disagree with that. Every president until through Bush's father had to manage the Cold War, which was infinitely more threatening to the existence of civilization than September 11th was. And in particular, if you want a particularly specific example, John F. Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis, which probably brought us closer to Armageddon than we've ever been. And the way Kennedy personally managed that crisis, if you've ever seen the movie 13 Days or listened to any of the tapes, it's an amazing story because he rejected the advice of very powerful people in his administration who claimed to know a lot more than he did. But his instincts were very good, and he made the decision that saved us all.
Audience questions. I'm going to collect a couple. To the right here, and then I want to get to the other side. I see a white sleeve halfway up. Keep that hand waving, and we'll get a microphone up to you.
Thank you. This is a question for Mr. Rove. I have great belief in the wisdom of the gross American population. If what you have said is about the Bush successes is true, how is it that his general approval record is so extraordinarily and historically low?
Okay, I'm going to hold that question, Carl, and collect a couple of others, but we will come to it. The gentleman with the white sleeve we spoke of.
This is also a question for Mr. Rove. If the United States is known for its constitution and for respect for the rule of law, how would you rate the Bush presidency? And as a follow-up question, why would you not testify in a criminal investigation relating to abuse of government power?
All right. We're going to take these two questions. Now, these questions are to Carl, but I see an opening a truck could drive through for your opponents to also be part of this conversation. Carl, the first question, why are the president's approval ratings so low?
Look, we're asking it's an unpopular war, and we're asking the country to do tough things for a long time. And the economy's bad. I would remind you, not to correct Mr. Weisberg, but there have been three presidents who had lower approval ratings that I'm aware of. Four. Carter, Nixon, Johnson, and Truman. Truman left office with numbers lower than this president's. History has judged each of these men differently after their departure. If I could respond to the second one, rule of law. First of all, I'm not aware that I've refused to testify in a criminal investigation. You may know something I don't know. You want to elucidate? I think what you may be suggesting is why will I not testify in front of the United States Congress? And the reason is because I believe in the rule of law. The rule of law that says there's a separation of powers between the executive and the legislative branches, and that the President of the United States has a right to receive confidential advice from his assistants, which has been upheld by the United States Supreme Court. Now, right now it's being relitigated again because the United States Senate did not like the answer the White House gave them in the summer of 2007. If I'm called upon and a court of law says that the president has no such right, I'll testify. In the House of Representatives and in the Senate, we have made numerous attempts to provide the Congress with the information that it's requested in a way that protects the right of a president and his prerogative to receive that kind of advice from his staff, from his confidential advisors. The Senate has refused to take any one of the options. The House refused to take five separate options that we gave them until finally some members of the House Judiciary Committee asked the questions that were being asked by the committee and sent them to me. And under penalty, I responded to those, and if you like, you can find my answers at rove.com. So I've answered them. But there is a rule of law, and we ought to respect that rule of law that says there is a separation of powers between the branches, and that's exactly why I've been directed by the President not to testify in front of Congress on these issues.
Simon Jenkins, I want to bring you into a conversation. The question was premised on the notion that America's image has always rested on its adherence to the rule of law, and that the years of the Bush administration have to some degree seen to have been a disintegration of the value of the Constitution. With Barack Obama now taking over, does the fact that he has this terrible image with which to compare himself give him a boost? Or does the fact that American leadership has been so diminished, respect for America has been so diminished, give him a terrible starting point?
Well, I think the origin of this whole part of the discussion is the response to 9/11. 9/11 is the starting point of almost everything that we've been talking about. And I think many people in Europe and indeed around the world simply feel that America overreacted. And so did Britain, I may say. So this is not something peculiar to America. It was a feeling that some new force had been unleashed on the world, to which we had to respond by restricting our normal customary defences of liberty. Now, I'm a libertarian, and I've always felt that was simply unnecessary. The reaction was an overreaction. The consequence of it, however, is that we have, in a sense, played the terrorist game. We've done what they wanted us to do, which was restrict our liberties, curb our liberties, behave in a certain way towards other states and other peoples that we would not normally have done before.
But I've heard Bill Kristol say, Bill, let me bring you into this. I've heard you say that when it comes to terrorism, rather than playing the terrorist game, that the president has succeeded in putting the terrorists on the run, which is why 9/11 was the only incident in this city.
Would that they were on the run.
Bill Kristol.
Well, they haven't been very successful here, and they haven't been very successful in Western Europe, and they've actually not been very successful elsewhere. Al-Qaeda has been a losing proposition for the last several years. There remains a huge problem of a jihadist impulse in the Islamic world, which is unfortunately abetted by certain states. But I think Bush has done a very good job of making terror a losing proposition, which is the most important thing he could have done, taken away their momentum, which, again, if we had not gone into Iraq and if we had lost in Iraq, that would have been the single most disastrous result. Bush turned that around. But I just don't buy this premise that we've radically curbed civil liberties. Bush has done less after the 9/11 attack than any other president has done, much, much less. He's been much more responsible than Franklin Roosevelt was after we were attacked in World War II. He's been much more solicitous of civil liberties than, if I might say, John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were, and Richard Nixon were during Vietnam. We've had, you know, some controversial calls and some tough calls. There were a couple of overreactions, which the Bush administration itself walked back. Jack Goldsmith and Attorney General Mukasey have, I think, corrected some slight, some controversial interpretations that probably went too far.
Yeah. One second.
Jacob Weisberg.
Jack Goldsmith was drummed out of the Bush administration for challenging those decisions, the torture memos.
He changed the actual Office of Legal Counsel policy, and Attorney General Mukasey is leaving the Bush legal program intact and, I think, totally defensible, and will not be changed much by Barack Obama.
If you read Goldsmith's book, he was driven out, more or less. But the point is, I appreciate how open-minded you are about some of these issues. But on the civil liberties issues, you're amazingly cavalier. Closing Guantanamo is no big deal. We have them here. We have them there. Torture, you won't second-guess the decisions. I mean, these go to the heart of the questions about the rule of law and the Constitution, and the question of whether terrorist suspects...
Bush has lost fewer court decisions than almost any president has. He lost 2 5-4 decisions. Maybe the five were right. Maybe Bush shouldn't have gone quite as far as he did in some of the claims he made about Guantanamo. But we are going to have to detain people. We're not going to be able to provide them all civil trials. I do not believe that is a way you can deal with terrorists captured on the battlefield.
Why can't you deal with them with military trials? We have an existing system of military trials.
Up
his own alternate system. We already had a system of military justice. He decided he needed his
cast. Signed legislation that Congress passed in 2005 and 2006.
Let's bring in Karl Rove. And I just want to say it's fine to register your reaction to this with applause. I heard it for Jacob. I haven't heard it for Bill Kristol. I mean, is there a sense of support for Bill Kristol's argument?
No, please.
Karl Rove.
Don't be doing that again, John. We lost 65-17. Come on, man. I'm delighted that we did.
I was trying to get the 17 to applause here.
You know, we got 8% of the vote in one of the precincts up here. I mean, come on, man. Come on. All right, look. It's clever to suggest that we ought to have the style of courtroom justice we provide to our military and provide that for enemy combatants. We shouldn't. That's what we've attempted to do in the military justice system is, to the greatest possible degree possible, duplicate our civil justice system. And are you suggesting that we ought to Mirandize these people and keep a chain of evidence and all the other things that we normally do in both military and civilian courts for terrorists?
Not at all. And people have far fewer rights under the military system. But the point is, under your system, they have no rights. The prisoners at Guantanamo were originally denied access to a lawyer. We couldn't even find out who was there. And the original claim by the Bush administration was that this applied to citizens as well as non-citizens. So if the Bush administration decided that you were suspected of terrorism, you could be held indefinitely without a lawyer, without a hearing, without a trial.
You know what?
I'm not saying
With all due respect, you're making it sound like everybody on the Upper West Side needs to worry about being sent to the re-education camps in Texas. And in reality, what it was focused at is if we picked up a U.S. citizen who was a terrorist on a battlefield abroad, would we subject them to U.S. law or would we treat them as a terrorist?
But here's what you slipped in. If we picked up someone who's a terrorist, what if they happen not to be a terrorist? Some of these people have been acquitted.
And the system has a process of review in which that determination can
anyway,
be made.
In the big picture, look, the fact is, in the big picture.
Name one guy you're worried about.
No, that's exactly
you're worried
right.
about John Lynn? You worry about him? What person
was the Bush administration bad at explaining their policies, especially abroad? Yes. Did people abroad take a kind of cavalier and really hypocritical sense of pleasure in decrying those ridiculous Americans with all this stuff, when they themselves, of course, as you know well, in continental Europe, treat their own citizens with many less rights, are much much nastier to their own minorities? Bush went out of his way, and with great success, to say this is not a war on Islam. We need to respect everyone's rights. He was incredibly solicitous, as he should have been, a Muslim Americans. We have Muslim Americans here have a much fairer and more equal playing field than Muslims do in most of these wonderful European countries that sit around having heart attacks. About 200 people held
Simon,
on top
of
let's, and let's just talk. Bush made two Supreme Court appointments. They were incredibly highly qualified, Alito Roberts. 61 appointments to federal courts. They were conservative, of course, as Obama's will be liberal. Extremely highly qualified judges. He made a couple of mistakes, I think, in his appointments out of excessive loyalty, perhaps with Alberto Gonzalez. But the fact is, Ashcroft was a serious attorney general. And then he brought in Mukasey, and he is leaving an intact and functioning legal system, which we can be proud of, given the threats we're facing.
Sodom, of course, had started all this 12 years ago when he'd gone down to Kuwait. He had gone out basically taking his followers, the Sodomites, out into the desert there. And, of course, they crossed a line in the sand. Now, let's talk about the line. This line was given to them free of charge, a perfectly good line. Was drawn there in 1922 by the British High Commissioner. I don't know what he was high on at that time, but he drew that line. And Sodom crossed over it. Why? Because he wanted to dominate the entire Arab world. Well, that's our job. So we had to go in there and protect the peoples of the Persian Gulf. And this is a very, very mysterious region, not to say inscrutable. That's further east, of course. But it is mysterious, and there are many things that even I don't understand, even with all my briefings, such as how did our oil get under Kuwait? No one could ever explain that to me. But then he was at it again with the weapons of mass destruction and so forth. You may have heard that some of that information was not information. Well, listen, I'm not really here to give you information so much as I'm here to get you in formation, you know. But the thing is that, well, we might as well just talk about it at this point. It's the Nigergate thing. This has to do with Sodom buying or attempting to buy yellow kick uranium from Niger. Some of you know it as Nigergate because you listen to the BBC, and, well, they're French, you know. But, of course, that Nigergate thing never happened, the way it was reported. Although, interestingly enough, we got that intelligence from Britain, and over in Britain, actually, it still happened. Yeah, it's very interesting, but former ambassador went over there, determined that it didn't happen, and then somebody who may or may not have been married to him may or may not have worked for the CIA, and that may have been exposed by somebody associated with the office of the President Bush there. So we're going to commission a study on this to get on top of it, not to cover it up, but to get to the bottom of it so we can get out in front of it and get it behind us, basically. Anyhow, we decided that we had to go take care of Sodom, and the French didn't understand that because they said, well, you're supposed to be looking for Osama. Why are you going after Sodom? Well, they didn't have the intelligence reports that we have and that we had received at that time, which indicated that Osama actually is hiding. Now, inquiring minds want to know where. small details. Well, most likely he had left already by that time Afghanistan in order to pass through the Sudan to get to Pharmaceutistan. And if you go that route, you can get up through Syria to Illyria and on to Iraq. Well, that is why we had to look for him in every country that ends in A, An, or Ak. Now, the French didn't know this. And as a result, you didn't know how to boycott the French. And that's hard, because if you boycott the wines, you might accidentally boycott California, and we need to do that later on purpose. Although we now have the Austro-Hungarian Empire in place there, so that's probably off in a distant future. But however, here it is. If you don't, next time it comes around that we have to boycott the French, you just don't buy anything that ends in an, en, or e, and you're fine. We explain to these people, the Germans too, we explain to these people, you're either with us or you're with the UN. It's that simple. Now, the old Europe was not with us. Luckily, we had already developed New Europe, and they were with us, and we had support from Slovenia, Estonia, Micronesia, basically all of the countries ending in EA were with us. The entire nation of Berlusconi supported us. You know, Turkey was with us. Well, not the people, but in general. And so they asked me to go over there, and I went with the coalition of the willing to be bought. And, of course, people said, what is it about? You're just going over there for the oil. It's not about the oil. If it was about oil, we would just bomb Texas. No, it's not. It's clearly not about the oil. It's about gasoline. This is the Terrorist International, which you know as the Axis of Evil. Now, the Axis of Evil, don't confuse that with the evil of access. That's an Enron thing. And that's that is a private business scandal having nothing to do with the government aside from the president, vice president, trade advisor, top political advisor. Also, Axis of Evil, not to be confused with the SUV problem, the Axles of Evil, totally different desk that they're on.
And now for something completely different.